This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, the 30th of November, 2006. From KPFK in LA, this is Aura Bogado. Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki meets with President Bush in Jordan to discuss the future of the war-torn country. Hundreds of thousands of demonstrators take to Australia's streets to voice their opposition to new labor laws. And the Portland-based Muslim lawyer, accused in connection to the Madrid train bombings, reaches a $2 million settlement with the federal government. We'll bring you those stories and more after the headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the Free Speech Radio News headlines. Hundreds are feared dead after 3 days of heavy fighting in southern Sudan. This week's surge in violence is the most serious since a peace agreement signed nearly 2 years ago ended the long-running civil war in southern Sudan. A resident of the southern city of Malakal told Reuters that dead bodies are lying in the streets and that desperate residents have been risking their safety to collect water from the river since the town's water service was cut off. In Colombia's southern province of Cauca, violence erupted yesterday when police tried to evict thousands of indigenous Nasa people who began a land recuperation on Monday. Nicole Carson has more.
A peaceful land recuperation in Cauca turned violent yesterday when police used tear gas and firearms to evict thousands of indigenous people. Seven Nasa people were injured, and three are reportedly missing. An improvised explosive device killed one policeman and injured three others. The land takeover began on November 27th to protest the government's failure to comply with an 11-month-old pact to compensate the Nasa people with some $85,000 worth of land. The settlement is for the killing of 20 Nasa people in 1991, known as the Massacre of El Nilo. Today, Northern Cauca's Government Association issued a communique saying it laments and condemns the death of the policeman and the use of violence. Indigenous authorities ask for an investigation into the killing since their movement has been characterized by nonviolence. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Nicole Carson in Bogota.
Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice met with Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas in Jericho today to discuss issues ranging from the humanitarian crisis in the occupied territories to the ceasefire in Gaza. Rice's visit coincides with a report issued by the UN accusing Israel of breaking all provisions in a year-old U.S. brokered agreement on Gaza's border crossings. Leila Haddad reports.
The agreement on movement and access, signed in November of last year following the Israeli disengagement, was supposed to facilitate the movement of Palestinian peoples and goods in and out of Gaza. It also promised Palestinian control over the Rafah crossing into Egypt by November of 2006, after a transitional year of European monitoring and Israeli video surveillance. At the time, the agreement was hailed by Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice as a breakthrough that would, quote, give the Palestinian people freedom to move, to trade, and to live ordinary lives. But according to a report released today by the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, Palestinians are worse off than they were a year ago, both in terms of their freedom of movement and their overall economic situation. All of Gaza's border passages, including the Rafah crossing, continue to be controlled by Israel, and movement between Gaza and the West Bank has become virtually impossible. Israel has only allowed through the Karni commercial crossing an average of 12 out of a promised 400 trucks a day, and access to Rafah, the only route in and out of Gaza for 1.4 million Palestinians, has been limited and erratic since June of this year. For FSRN at the Rafah crossing, I'm Leila Al-Haddad.
Talks between U.S. and North Korean envoys this week made little progress to restart stalled six-party nuclear negotiations. From Seoul, FSRN's Jason Strother reports.
Washington's chief negotiator, Undersecretary of State Christopher Hill, met in Beijing this week with his North Korean counterpart. The U.S.'s central demand is that Pyongyang certifiably relinquish its entire atomic program, something that the North says is impossible without security guarantees and the lifting of economic sanctions. Mr. Hill told reporters Thursday that he is still hopeful that the rounds will restart by the end of this year. The nation's reclusive leadership raised the stakes in October when it test-fired a nuclear device. North Korea soon after pledged its return to the negotiations, but talks have been frozen since last September. Reporting for Free Speech Radio News in Seoul, I'm Jason Strother.
The Federal Communications Commission will hold a public hearing on media ownership today in Seattle. Mark Taylor Canfield has more.
Media activists are gathering in Seattle today to testify before FCC commissioners Edelstein and Copps on the negative effects that corporate media consolidation has had on communities across the U.S. Recent studies concluded that further corporate media consolidation can result in less local media news coverage. Activists say that relaxing current restrictions on media ownership will only lead to more giant media monopolies controlling the information that most Americans receive every day through radio or television broadcasts. The FCC plans to rule on any changes to their rules on media ownership next year. The public comment period will end by January 2007. This is Mark Taylor Canfield in Seattle for Free Speech Radio News.
And I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
In Washington, President Bush will come home from Jordan to ideas on how the U.S. should proceed in Iraq. The Baker-Hamilton Commission is set to release their recommendations next week, suggesting a gradual troop withdrawal, a plan Bush has already rejected. But Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki set what could be called a timeline, saying that Iraqi forces should be ready to take over by June 2007. Washington editor Leanne Caldwell reports.
The Baker-Hamilton Commission has completed their report. They decided against giving a timeline for troop withdrawal, which President Bush is also opposed to. Instead, the New York Times reports the Iraq Study Group recommended a gradual troop withdrawal with no set timetable. Following a meeting with Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki, Bush rejected their idea of a slow withdrawal, saying he will stay to help the Iraqi security forces take control of their country.
Our goal is to ensure that the Prime Minister has more capable forces under his control so his government can fight the terrorists and the death squads and provide security and stability in his country.
Al-Maliki then gave a timeline. He said his security forces should be able to take full control by June of 2007. Neither Bush nor al-Maliki gave details on how the transition would take place. Robert Perito is with the U.S. Institute of Peace. He was on an advisory board for the Baker-Hamilton Commission. He refers to the postponement of the meeting by one day after Muqtada al-Sadr's coalition pulled their support from the Iraqi government.
I was struck and rather disturbed by the fact that Muqtada al-Sadr and his organization could force al-Maliki to cancel the meeting with Bush yesterday. I mean, that's an enormous sign of strength.
The U.S. has been pressuring al-Maliki to quiet Muqtada al-Sadr's militia. But Dr. Sharifa Zuhur is professor of Islamic and Regional Studies at the Strategic Studies Institute at the Army War College. She says fighting militias should not be the priority. It should be diminishing sectarian violence. She says sectarian violence is about power, not about religion.
Mr. Average on the street, whether he's a militia member or he's not a militia member, if his expectation is that this civil strife will continue and that, you know, he just has to learn how to survive in this kind of environment, then cooperation with the government is not a pressing need. If the government is able to offer goods because some of the violence is contained, then everyone has more incentive to cooperate. So it's a very, very difficult point in time.
Also next week, which could influence a change in U.S. policy, Robert Gates will testify before the Senate Armed Services Committee to be the next Secretary of Defense. In a written testimony to the committee, Gates said he supported talks with Iran and Syria. He said he supports open channels of communication, even in the most difficult of situations. The Baker-Hamilton report is expected to also suggest open dialogue with those countries, something many experts in the United States support, including Dr. Zuhur.
I think there probably will be a recommendation for a bigger summit meeting with more involvement of Arab neighbors. And I think that engagement with Iran would be a positive step, a necessary step.
President Bush has refused any contact with Iran, saying Iraq can talk to them, but the U.S. won't do so. Reuters is reporting the National Security Director, Stephen Hadley, says a shift in U.S. strategy could emerge in the next few weeks. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
President Bush and Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki met in Jordan today to discuss the transfer of security in the volatile, sectarian-torn Iraq. Bush and Maliki met for 2.5 hours and announced that they agree Iraq should not be partitioned into separate zones. FSRN's Ula Farawati reports from Amman.
Acknowledging the pressures at home for the beginning of U.S. troops' withdrawal from Iraq, President Bush said the troops were going to stay to get the job done.
We talked today about accelerating authority to the prime minister so he can do what the Iraqi people expect him to do, and that is bring security to parts of his country that require firm action. It's going to... The presence of the United States will be in Iraq so long as the government asks us to be in Iraq. This is a sovereign government.
The meeting between the two leaders was shadowed by a White House leak that questioned Prime Minister Maliki's capacity for stopping violence in Iraq. The two leaders were scheduled to meet on Wednesday, but the opening session was cancelled following disclosure of a U.S. administration doubts and a Baghdad protest of his attendance. However, the tension over the turn of events was not apparent when the leaders appeared together before reporters. President Bush went out of his way to commend Prime Minister al-Maliki and his government.
This is a government that is dedicated to a pluralism and rule of law. It's a government elected by the Iraqi people under a constitution approved by the Iraqi people, which in itself is an unusual event in the Middle East, by the way.
President Bush continued to reject drawing Iraq into helping Iraq in its struggle for peace. Al-Maliki, however, left the door open for countries like Iran to play a part.
We will be punishing anyone who violates the rule of the state. The major principle we hold is the sovereignty of the state, which is shouldering the security and political responsibility in Iraq. We welcome help from those who want to help the government.
However, Iraqi Member of Parliament Hussein Fallujah, who represents the Sunni al-Wifaq bloc, said al-Maliki has to work harder on bringing Iraqis together.
What we need from the Prime Minister is to be representative of all Iraqis and to quell all the rumors saying that his government is encouraging sectarianism in a divided Iraq.
President Bush's meeting with Prime Minister al-Maliki was part of a new string of diplomatic action the U.S. administration said was undertaking across the Middle East. The question remains whether Prime Minister al-Maliki will be able to deliver on the promises he made to the Bush administration and to the Iraqi people that he will very soon bring security to Qiyas-wrecked Iraq. In Amman, Jordan, this is Ola Farawati reporting for Free Speech Radio News.
Portland lawyer Brandon Mayfield was wrongfully arrested in connection with the 2004 Madrid train bombings that killed 191 people. Mayfield's lawyers announced Wednesday they had reached a settlement in their civil suit against the federal government for a sum of $2 million. FSRN's Julie Sabatier has more on the story from Portland, Oregon.
Brandon Mayfield called a press conference Wednesday to announce the settlement agreement in his lawsuit against the United States, Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez, the FBI, and certain federal agents. Flanked by his wife, Mona, and his attorney, Eldon Rosenthal, Mayfield read from a prepared statement.
The days and weeks and months following my arrest were some of the hardest and darkest that myself and my family have ever had to endure, and all because of this government's ill-conceived war on terror.
After his fingerprint was falsely linked to a print lifted from a bag of detonators from the Madrid train bombings, Mayfield, a Muslim, spent 2 weeks in custody. He was released when Spanish National Police correctly linked the print lifted from the bag of detonators to an Algerian national. Mayfield and his family were subjected to covert surveillance for at least a month prior to his arrest.
There was signs of their burglaries, of their spying, of their break-in. They left doors that were previously unbolted, bolted. They even left footprints on newly vacuumed floors in a home where by custom we don't wear shoes in the house. However, to this date, the government has refused to tell us where they place their electronic devices and cameras, leaving myself and family to forever wonder if they were listening to our most private conversations, watching our most intimate interactions.
The government has agreed to destroy all surveillance tapes as part of the settlement. FBI Special Agent in Charge for Oregon, Robert Jordan, has apologized for the mistaken fingerprint match, but he maintains that Mayfield was not targeted because of his Muslim faith.
I wouldn't change a thing that the FBI here in Oregon did by way of follow-up. We did a very professional investigation. It was predicated on a fingerprint that was later determined to be a bad match.
Agent Jordan says that the FBI has made changes in their procedure for intake and analysis of fingerprints to guard against mistakes like this in the future. While Mayfield and his lawyers have settled their civil case for a $2 million sum, they still intend to challenge the constitutionality of the USA Patriot Act in court. For FSRN, this is Julie Sabatier in Portland, Oregon.
Iowa Governor Tom Vilsack became the first Democrat to announce his candidacy for president today.
Our country needs a president who wants to make us more secure by confronting our problems. Our country today needs a president who will lead bold change and has the courage of his convictions. And I intend to be that president.
Vilsack admits he is less known than other possible candidates, such as Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama. His campaign will focus on ending the country's dependence on foreign oil and becoming a leader in renewable energy, something he's already helped accomplish in his state of Iowa. On the eve of Mexican President-elect Felipe Calderón's inauguration, tensions flare in the Congress, and the southern state of Oaxaca continues to suffer a series of massive human rights violations. Fear reigns in the streets of this once attractive tourist city as the Federal Preventive Police violates agreements reached between the Mexican government and teachers' union, escalating roundups of movement sympathizers that extend to schoolyards. In the transition of power, congressional representatives are resorting to fistfights as the right-wing National Action Party attempts to take over the tribunal to secure Friday's hotly disputed presidential inauguration in Mexico City. From Oaxaca, Vladimir Flores and Tim Russo bring us more on the current situation.
At the crack of dawn on Tuesday in Oaxaca City, the last remaining barricades established by the Popular Assembly of the People of Oaxaca months ago were dismantled by Federal Preventative Police. Little resistance was encountered during the operation. At approximately 5:50 p.m., Radio Universidad, the radio that has been controlled by the APO since late October, was turned over to the university rector and officially went off the air for fear of an imminent police operation against them. Sara Mendez from the Oaxacan Human Rights Network comments on the illegal transfer of 141 political prisoners from Oaxaca to Rincón, Nayarit, and the systematic violation of human rights experienced in Oaxaca at this moment.
Pues estamos también exigiendo que cesen los actos de intimidación y autoritarismo por parte de los elementos de la Policía Federal.
We are demanding an end to acts of intimidation and authoritarianism by the Federal Preventative Police and different police forces that have been acting in an irregular manner in our state. We are talking about parapolice. Hopefully we are not yet talking about paramilitaries. In the case of the detainees, since November 25th, the situation has been very difficult. They are accusing people, but we are not even sure, nor is the government sure, that they were really in the demonstrations. They have been charged with arson and diverse robberies. They have been severely beaten inside of the prisons, and there are underaged people that are among those that were moved illegally to the prison in Nayarit.
The recent announcement by President-elect Felipe Calderón naming Francisco Ramírez Acuña, the governor of Jalisco, as his Secretary of Interior has raised fears that the governor's tarnished record towards human rights will translate into an aggressive stance towards resolving the six-month-old conflict in Oaxaca. Acuña has been denounced by Amnesty International on several occasions for his heavy-handed approach. Acuña.
I believe that sometimes we confuse having a firm hand with other actions. A firm hand is, in a sense, being able to make firm decisions, and sometimes in Mexican politics we have forgotten to apply this.
Subsecretary of the Interior Arturo Chavez was scheduled to reinstall suspended peace negotiations with the APO Tuesday, but has not yet arrived. Representatives of the APO steering committee, all of whom are trying to avoid arrest warrants, were forced to take refuge for two nights at the Church of the Poor, where the State Forum for Indigenous Rights was being held. Joel Aquino from the Sierra Norte of Oaxaca spoke about the conflict at the forum.
The communities have lived for many years in submission to the brutal system of the pre-henchmen that today are expressed in the thought and actions of Governor Ulysses Ruiz. The resistance by the Oaxacan people is invincible because there are 10,000 communities, 16 cultures, and 16 languages. Oaxaca has all of the spiritual force for its communal concept, and it has the spiritual capacity and the physical capacity to build a project for a new government.
as family members, teachers, and people deemed Apple have been disappeared, snatched up by unmarked cars, and detained by federal preventative police, raising the number of documented detainees to at least 179 people, a sense of terror has overwhelmed this once very relaxed city. Emmeline Green, a bilingual teacher from Santa Cruz, California, has decided to leave Mexico after seeing an article that accuses foreigners of being involved in the conflict and hearing calls from the right-wing Radio Ciudadano to turn in, attack, and kill Apple leaders, journalists, and foreigners.
I certainly don't feel able to do anything here alone. It's been tense here before when the PFP entered. It was pretty tense, but I still felt like I could go alone to the corner store. And I honestly don't feel that I can do that here right now. Because it's a city under martial law, and it's martial law under a specific police force that has been known to rape women, and that also has explicitly threatened to target foreigners who are here. So I don't feel like I can do anything by myself, so I'm just going to go home.
In the meantime, 3,500 elements of the Federal Preventative Police and military battened down the hatches outside the Congress in Mexico City to keep protesters from reaching the presidential inaugural ceremony on Friday. Yet the real disturbances could be inside the Congress itself, where congressional representatives from opposition parties have said they will not permit the transfer of powers from President Vicente Fox to President-elect Felipe Calderón. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Tim Russo with Vladimir Flores in Oaxaca, Mexico.
Hundreds of thousands of people took to the streets in Australia today to voice their opposition to the industrial relations reforms introduced by the federal government late last year, which demonstrators say make millions of workers more vulnerable to unfair dismissal. The government has also introduced individual contracts known as Australian Workplace Agreements, which critics say give employers the upper hand to single out workers. Under these new laws, unions have also been weakened with the threat of massive fines for industrial action. The industrial relations reforms were opposed by the Australian Labor Party, the Greens, and the Democrats, but because John Howard's Liberal Party has the majority in the Senate, he was able to push them through. Cinema Napard has more from the streets of Sydney.
Annette Harris worked for a major retailer for over 2 years and was about to take her annual leave when her employer decided to change her position from part-time to casual and then asked her to sign an AWA, which gave her a pay rise of 2 cents an hour and also changed the terms of her employment.
But it cut all of my penalty rates, it took away leave loading, and it even took away my tea break. John Howard used to be my hero. New laws have changed that now. These IR laws have taken away my rights and my pay, and they've given them to my employer.
Harris's story is one of many. Sharon Burrows is the president of the Australian Council of Trade Unions. She spoke at the Melbourne rally today about the problems employees face under individual contracts.
It is a fact that every AWA made under these laws has removed award conditions. Overtime, penalty rates, public holidays, all systematically stripped away. If you start a new job or get a promotion, you can be asked to sign an individual contract, an AWA. If you don't sign, you don't get the job.
Under the new laws, the government has weakened the unions, making it harder for them to protect and represent employees.
We remember when Australia was a place where we valued democratic rights, but now every single worker can be fined $6,000 for just asking for protection against unfair dismissal. Unions can be fined $33,000 for asking for occupational health and safety training. Disgraceful. These are disgraceful laws. They have no place in a democratic society.
On a rail construction site earlier this year, the union delegate sent everyone home because of safety issues, and the company responded by firing him. The workers took industrial action, and the case went to the Industrial Relations Commission, which ruled in favour of the union delegate. The dispute was settled, and everyone went back to work. But 4 months later, the federal government charged the workers with breaching the new industrial relations laws. 107 people now face fines of up to $28,000. These are just some of the things people were protesting about today.
We're here to fight John Howard's unjust and unfair work practices and laws. A boss just can't come in and sack you for no reason whatsoever, and that's what they're legally allowed to do now.
We're here to protect the entitlements that we fought generations to actually build. Proper penalty rates, proper rostering provisions, the capacity for people to be able to balance work and family. It's so important.
New South Wales Premier Maurice Yemma is a vocal opponent of the new industrial relations laws and believes if the laws can't be changed, perhaps Australia needs a change of government.
We don't want an Australia that says to our kids, here's the minimum wage, here are the tips and the charity that the working poor in places like the United States have to rely on. We think that there's a better Australia, one in which the values of decency, of respect and dignity are part of everyday life in the workplace.
For Free Speech Radio News in Sydney, I'm Cinnamon Nippard.
It's a dangerous drug that can be produced at home and spreads fast. Tribe after tribe, Indian communities are bedeviled by the highly addictive and equally crippling methamphetamine, or meth. Today, on National Methamphetamine Awareness Day, Native American tribal leaders teamed up with the federal government to launch a program dedicated to educating Indian youth on the harms of meth. FSRN's Yameshe reports.
Several tribes in Montana were among the earliest engulfed by meth rampage. Carol Langford is a tribal leader from southern Montana, also a mother of four.
I have had a child who has struggled with this issue, and it hurt because I felt like I failed.
In order to awaken young people to the devastation of meth, community groups in Montana launched the Montana Meth Project. Langford says the campaign is working.
What it's doing is it has billboards, it has a strong message, and it's getting out there and it's making a difference because these kids are seeing these billboards of what you look like today and in 3 years what people look like after doing meth for 3 years.
Today, the U.S. government dedicated $3,000 to extending the Montana experience to Indian tribes nationwide. Jackie Johnson is the executive director of National Congress of American Indians.
Included in this national campaign, there'll be the radio and the print ads and educational materials that will go right at our schools, educational pieces that will go right into the schools and to work with the schools, as well as working with the Boys and Girls Clubs across America.
Part of the funding for this program comes from the Bureau of Indian Affairs of the Interior Department. The Interior Secretary Dirk Kempthorne says messages in the campaign has to respect Native American cultures in order to assure success.
I think that we need to have people from Indian country that help us with the thoughts, with an identification of what particular sensitivities do we need to be mindful of. I also think that included in that we need to talk to the younger generation and find out from them, what are your suggestions? What is it would capture your imagination?
Compared with other races, Native Americans have the highest rate of meth abuse, partly because Indian reservations are easily infiltrated by drug dealers due to lack of law enforcement resources. Kempthorne recognizes there are deeper causes for drug abuse among Indians, such as poverty and lack of opportunities.
Somebody has to have a job to feel good about themselves, to earn the income so that they can provide for their family. And so we're working. We have some tremendous programs on economic development. We're not there yet.
As for Langford, she has helped her son to realize the evil of meth. He is recovering and spreading the message to others. For Free Speech Radio News, Ye Meixie in Washington, D.C.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. From KPFK in L.A., this is Laura Bogado.
That's right. That was the FSRN Evening News right here on KBOO with a report from our own Julie Sabatier. Right now, though, we have a story coming up by Marlise Franklin. She's presenting a special segment on the global movement of mental health treatment survivors. Tonight she interviewed David Oakes of Mind Freedom and Dr. Dan Fisher, Executive Director of the National Empowerment Center. Then right after that, we'll have the KBOO report with Cherie Blackfeather. So stay tuned and always thank you for your support on KBOO.
We are joined today by David Oakes of Mind Freedom International and Daniel Fisher with the National Empowerment Center. And I would like for each of you to do introduce yourselves, if you would. Would you like to go first, Dan?
Sure. My name is Dan Fisher. My first experience with the mental health system actually was as a person receiving services on an involuntary basis. I was hospitalized on several occasions in my 20s and was diagnosed with schizophrenia and quite frankly thought my life might be over in terms of my dreams. I became a psychiatrist and I've been working ever since then to try to change the way we're viewed and treated, and also was on the New Freedom Commission, the White House New Freedom Commission for Mental Health.
Okay, yeah. I'm David Oakes, director of Mind Freedom International, and this is my 30th year of being a human rights activist for what we call a nonviolent revolution in the mental health system of human rights and alternatives. Mind Freedom unites about 100 grassroots groups, and we're based right here in Eugene, Oregon. We're a nonprofit, and we're one of the few groups of our kind to be accredited by the United Nations. A majority of our members are psychiatric survivors. That is, they identify as having experienced human rights violations in the mental health system, though we are open to the public. And my introduction to this work was I was a working class kid going to Harvard, had emotional problems, and ended up being forcibly drugged and solitary confinement and really abused and traumatized by the mental health system. So in my senior year, I volunteered to help advocate for people in the mental health system, and I graduated, and this became my career, is being an advocate, activist, to change the mental health system.
Let's move on to what happened here in Portland last month that was really an historical event.
Yeah, I've been to the alternatives conferences for many years.
Could you explain to us what that is, the Alternatives Conference?
Yeah, I sure will.
Sure.
I've been going for more than 20-some years. It's a federally funded conference. In the mid-1980s, the federal government realized, hey, people who've been through the mental health system are doing some good stuff to get on their own 2 feet and to promote peer support and advocacy. And so the federal government threw a crumb in the direction of this meeting, and a federal crumb is pretty darn big. So for a quarter century, people have been gathering, and this one had 700 people from all over the United States, people labeled with psychiatric disabilities, and a lot of them are running great programs. They're running drop-in centers, peer support groups, advocacy programs, public education programs. And there's actually hundreds of people now employed providing peer support services to each other, and this conference brought a lot of those folks together.
And Dan, could you talk about how people did come together and what was one of the main things that happened, one of the evenings there where some of the leaders got together? And
sure. For many years, probably 20-plus years of the consumer movement, we've been trying to put together a national consumer survivor organization or network. And for various reasons, it's been difficult to do that. But recently, I think there's been enough of a development of the movement and enough people, enough parts of the country realize the need to come together that during the last 6 months, we, through the Empowerment Center, started to conduct a series of teleconferences of what are called statewide consumer networks. And these statewide groups have now joined together about 20-plus states that have consumer-run organizations across their states and have joined together to form a national coalition. And at Alternatives, 130 representatives of these different statewide groups and other consumer survivors got together and were able to have really initial face-to-face meeting. And we've come up with a set of principles that unify us. I think another reason we're able to form such a coalition is because we realize that we have commonality of experience and that recovery and being able to find a meaningful place in the community and to overcome stigma and discrimination and to be self-determining citizens are overriding concerns that we all have, regardless of our diagnosis or our background or any of these sorts of factors. I want to add also that we have hired now a public policy person, Lauren Spiro, who's in Washington, D.C., and she and I yesterday spent a day at the Capitol of our country, and we were able to get three very important meetings with staff representatives for Ted Kennedy, from Patrick Kennedy's office, and from Senator Tom Harkin's office. And these senators and congressmen, they play very important roles in the regulations involving Medicaid and involving Social Security and involving the funding of mental health.
David, would you like to comment on that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we support this new National Coalition of Consumer Survivor Organizations. Similar activity has gone on in Europe for quite a number of years. Historically, in the U.S., one thing that stopped it is that a lot of folks here were pretty radical and were worried about government co-optation. That is, that having mental health system-funded organizations form a coalition, that there would be co-optation. But I think over the years, this movement has grown in strength and sophistication so that we can encourage like a diversity of approaches. Listeners may want to know this social change movement about changing the mental health system. It's different than the environmental movement. It's different than working on racism issues. It's different than these other social change movements because our constituency is so poor and oppressed. I would say 95% of any kind of activity is system funded. It's funded by the mental health system. And that creates special problems in terms of organizing. Because how, you know, are you really going to expect the government to fund its changing the government? And so it's good that this coalition got an independent grant to do that. That said, it does appear to be kind of from the start an organization of government-funded groups. The core startup groups, half a dozen of the statewide groups have budgets of $500,000, $600,000 a year, which isn't huge for an agency, but is enormous in terms of the independent movement or the activist movement. And those are the startup groups like Vermont, Ohio, Maryland, California. These are all groups with more than $500,000 a year budgets. So it's important for those groups to get together, organize, and help start similar groups in other states. That said, I think it's important to know that there's, different parts of the movement have to work well together. So we support that process. And as I mentioned at the meeting at Alternatives, remember people in the government-funded movement that there is an independent movement, you know, out here, and acknowledge our existence kind of thing. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. I could say a word about that because David and I have worked together for many years, and I think that it's analogous a little bit to the greater disability movement where there are independent living centers that have come together, and they do receive, independent living centers also receive some government funding. And they can work sort of somewhat more within the system, but there's ADAPT that works more outside the system, more independently. And we need David's group as much in a way as David needs our group. Together, I think we can do a tremendous amount because they respect, a lot of these government agencies respect, and we respect very much what David and MindFreedom do, and their freedom and their independence. And I think what we can do is then take a lot of these ideas and try to change policies.
You two say that you are consumer survivors. Could you explain what that means for us, please?
What do we mean by that? Well, there's first of all, we don't like the old term, which was chronic mental patient.
Okay.
He feels that's obviously very demeaning and also very hopeless sounding. So then there was a move to change that and say, well, people who are receiving mental health services would rather be termed mental health consumers or mental health clients. However, some of us have gotten involuntary services that are involuntary treatment, and we don't necessarily feel that that we are consumers. We feel sometimes we've been survivors of the system. So then there's psychiatric survivors. And then there's some people that also use the term ex-patient who really feel that they've left the system or no longer receiving service. All we have in common is that we've at some point in our life been labeled with mental illness, which we don't necessarily believe is a biological condition, but is an interruption in our life due to some severe distress that interfered with our ability to work or go to school.
Yeah, it's really self-defined, and it's not about political correctness. I mean, for instance, gypsies, now a lot of them prefer to be called the Rom people, and some prefer to be called gypsies. It's really a way of a population getting a voice for itself, and one first step is to try to define what we want to be called. And kind of reflecting what I was talking about earlier is there's a mental health consumer movement of folks who are currently using the mental health system, and then there's a lot of us that not necessarily forcibly treated, but have felt abused by the mental health system. More and more, actually, the main human rights abuse is that when you go for help, you're upset, you have a family member who's upset, you go for help, and there's only one kind of, quote, voluntary care available, and that's usually the label, drug approach. The label, drug
so
model.
Why don't you just speak briefly about what that means?
I try to sum it up because we're talking about the mind, which is, you know, one of the most complex things that are out there, and so it can be, this subject can be really intimidating to a lot of folks, but what we're talking about is really getting hands-on with the mental health system, democracy getting hands-on with it, and bringing with it principles about getting empowered and having a voice and speaking up for yourself. That's opposite of what the current mental health system is. The current mental health system tends to be pretty disempowering. If you're in crisis, if you're feeling upset, suicidal, or you're just really, really very, very different than other people and help is offered, it tends to be a medical model. And Dan and I are not anti-medical model. Sometimes the system will try to portray us as anti-psychiatrists or anti-drug. What we are is pro-freedom, is that some of our members choose to take prescribed psychiatric drugs, but there ought to be a range of choices available. And more, the average distressed family, if a family has a distressed family member, there's only one kind of help that's offered, a prescription. And so it's kind of a drug company takeover of the mental health system. And so that's what we're really about is that a lot of folks are identifying themselves as psychiatric survivors just because they were pressured by circumstance to have help that they didn't want because there was no other help available.
Well, or they weren't informed or they weren't educated as to what other help was available.
Right, and they were lied to. The population now has been told thousands of times on TV ads and articles that they have a chemical imbalance. If you're in the mental health system, you have a chemical imbalance and you have to be on a psych drug to fix it. Total fiction, never been proven. No study backs that up.
Yeah, I'd reinforce what David's saying. Additionally, I have the firsthand experience of having worked as a biochemist at the National Institute of Mental Health for 5 years. And I believed at that time that we could find a chemical basis of what is described as mental illness. And actually, the pursuit of that research played a role in my own breakdown because I started to believe that we all were just a set of chemicals. And that belief, I think, actually is one of the bases of people not being able to recover because you don't feel as though you're an agent in your life. And I would just add also to what Dave was saying that we're not we're not anti-medical. I am a psychiatrist, and on a voluntary basis, I prescribe medication, but I am pro both freedom and pro-recovery, and that people can choose and need to choose their own pathway of how they recover, but it's very individualized. And that's what we try to promote as a movement.
And I think that word recovery is a very important word, because it means that there is hope and that that people can recover, which I think in maybe more primeval terms as of maybe even 10 years ago, a lot of people didn't really think that there is any hope to recover.
Not only 10 years ago, Marilise, but unfortunately today,
now, still.
There's still an awful lot of people. I'll give you really a poignant example. Recently, I was in Newport, Oregon, and I was giving a talk, and there was a 13-year-old boy in the front row squirming around a bit, and I thought, wonder if this is getting through. Well, his mother came up at lunchtime and said, I said, did it help him any? She said, I think you saved his life. Said, why was that? She said, at age 10, he was diagnosed with bipolar disorder, and he never heard that he could recover, and he's been suicidal ever since. He said hearing my life story and my life experience gave him hope that he could have a future and that he could have a life, and now he's not suicidal anymore.
So let's talk about how the movement has grown. What are some of the surprises? You both have been working with this for 30 years that you never really saw coming even 30 years or 20 years ago?
Well, I think that, this is David, the thing I'm surprised by is how much of what we warned about came true. You know, as activists 30 years ago, you can kind of tend to hyperbole and warn, you know, hey, the mental health system is after everybody, you know? And I'm surprised about just how much that has come true, because 30 years ago, this was about the back wards. It was about people like Dan and me who are tied down or locked up or forcibly drugged. There are people out there getting electroshock and so forth, and that's still going on. There's no doubt about it. But more and more, it's about your neighbor or your friend or your relative or the general population. It's such an intense amount of psychiatric drugging. And multiple drugs, 3, 4, 5 drugs to young people, to 3 years old, 3-year-old kids. So it's become a mainstream issue. In a way, our movement has to catch up. You know, the general population is getting worried about the drugging of the world, and they ought to be. So again, we're pro-choice, but this kind of approach has gotten way bigger than I ever imagined it would 30 years ago. The other change, real quickly, is that the mental health system has learned a lot of the right words to say. I will go to a conference on mental health and almost always hear about great principles like peer support, advocacy, alternatives, recovery, transformation, trauma-informed, person-centered, you know, all these wonderful buzzwords. The system is really great, and that's good. We ought to applaud the buzzwords, and they'll have mental health consumers at the table, and that's good. But we really need to watch out for just buzzwords and tokenism. We need really substantive change. And one example I'll give is I'm surprised how I can go to a conference on transformation or recovery for several days, and nobody's talking about the power of the drug companies or the hazards from the psychiatric drugs. And I think that is a bit of co-optation going on, and we have to bring it up. We have to talk about the power of the drug companies and the medical model, always emphasizing that we're coming from a pro-freedom kind of point of view, that it's okay that if you want to use prescribed drugs, great, but this is a crisis. This is an emergency on a global scale, and I'll just mention the World Health Organization and the World Bank want 100 million more people in the world to be on psychiatric drugs over the next coming years. They want the globalization of this kind of Western Ritalin, Prozac, Zoloft, Zyprexa kind of chemical cocktail approach.
What David's bringing up is absolutely true, and it turns out, and we're not opposed to medication, but it does turn out that in the so-called developing countries that haven't experienced such a high rate of medication usage, that the recovery from severe emotional problems, recovery rate is higher than in the industrialized countries. So the mere presence of medication not only does not solve these problems, but the amount in which they're being used may be contributing to the problem.
Could you just repeat that again?
World Health Organization has done two studies now. One was in 1979, one was in 1992. They repeated it because they couldn't believe the results. In both these studies, they compared the long-term recovery rate of people diagnosed with schizophrenia in developing countries such as India, and they compared them with industrialized countries such as England and the United States. And much to their shock and their dismay, they found the recovery rate was much higher in the developing countries than in the industrialized countries. And meanwhile, the use of medication was approximately 16% in the developing countries of what it was in the industrialized. To me, it should be front page news. This is one of the biggest proofs that these are not primarily biological. If they're primarily biological, then the rate would not be higher just because the culture of the civilization is different. But we see this now repeated, and it points out that much bigger factors are social and cultural factors, much bigger factors in whether recover or don't recover.
So what would those factors be?
Well, the one of the major factors that's come out from our own research on recovery is the importance of meaningful relationships and social networks. And this is borne out when you look at developing countries, they still have cohesive social units. They have communities where people know each other. I'll give you a real quick example. In Ghana, a friend of mine has been working there to start a college, a branch of Cambridge College in Ghana. And there's a 24-year-old boy, and he worked at the college, and his mother tragically and traumatically was killed in an automobile accident. He went into another reality, which is called psychosis, withdrew from everyday reality. And the Westerners all wanted him in a hospital on medication right away. However, he came from a village in Ghana. Mm-hmm. And the mothers and grandmothers from that village who knew him said, if we take him in to our house, we believe that he'll be able to recover. So they won the day, and they took him in, and each took care of him over about a four-week period, and he fully recovered without hospitalization, without medication, and he's been back at work for 3 years now.
So
this
would you
sort of model is what we need to replicate.
So would you say that we are sort of addicted to pharmaceuticals, or that they are becoming a habit so that we don't even consider? I mean, it sounds like they weren't even considering any other kind of model, that is something that...
Well, I'll mention on a positive note, if you're in the Western world, if you're in the industrialized world, and you're a young person diagnosed schizophrenic, like Dan and I were when we were young people, that's when people often are diagnosed schizophrenic as in their late teens. If you're in an industrialized world, the only country where you can have a good chance of a non-drug approach is Finland. Finland has parts of Finland have a non-drug approach called a dialogue model, where they send out a team to meet with your family and you and do an extensive period of counseling and peer support and discussion for months and try to get through the crisis without drugs. That's the only place that we know of where there's funding by the government for a non-drug approach. The Western world has some severe problems. I often point to the movie Inconvenient Truth by Al Gore to wake people up. They have to see the movie in order to understand that what we're talking about here today is not about 5% or 10% or 15% of the population. This is the human experience, to experience distress and overwhelm and altered states and so forth. This is the human experience. It's really a universal experience of distress. There's not that huge of a difference between our extremely distressed members and the general public. There's more similarities than there are differences. So we need to really offer a range of approaches and alternatives. And one first step is to have the voices of people who've been through the mental health system out there in the public so that people can hear from folks about what has worked and get those voices out there and get them to the table.
I'd like to also mention that peer support, which David mentioned earlier, has been demonstrated now as a very effective and in some ways more effective than professional support in helping people to recover. And I've been teaching people, mental health consumers in Louisiana, in the post-Katrina and the post-Rita hurricane period, to provide peer support, and it's been very effective in helping people to get through their trauma and get through the distress. And now in Oregon, there's David Rompriak, who's been working with the Department of Mental Health on a disaster planning to have peer support be part of Oregon's response to disasters. And they're so interested in it, Department of Mental Health there, they're saying maybe this approach could help. You can have peers who, you know, have recovered from our own forms of psychiatric distress help the general public. And by all means, I think that what we've learned through our own recovery can be a very helpful resource to the general public, not only at times of disaster, but in times of just ongoing disaster of daily life.
How do people find out about these various groups? Do they go online?
We have an 800 number at the National Empowerment Center that people can call. It's 1-800-POWER. The number 2, letter U, 1-800-POWER-TO-YOU.
Mm-hmm.
We also have a website, power, the number 2, letter U, dot org, powertoyou.org. And we're able to provide people with videos, DVDs about people's recovery, and we can also hook them up with local support groups and connect them with this national coalition that we mentioned earlier.
And how about you, David?
Sure, Marlise. People can just Google Mind Freedom, one word, Mind Freedom, or go to mindfreedom.org, or our toll-free number is 1-877-MAD-PRIDE, 1-877-MAD-PRIDE, or they can email me, Oaks, O-A-K-S, at mindfreedom.org.
Thank you very much, David Oaks and Dan Fisher. David Oaks with Mind Freedom International and Dr. Daniel Fisher with the National Empowerment Center. Thank you both for joining us here this afternoon on KBOO 90.7 in Portland. And we have about a minute for each of you to wrap it up and to say anything that we may have missed. David Oaks.
Yeah, it's been difficult to connect with folks over the years. There's been a ghettoization of people who've been through the mental health system. The main problem, I feel, after 30 years, is the mainstream media. I don't think it's any coincidence that KBOO Radio is the main source of information over my 23 years here in Oregon. It's been KBOO Radio and some of the alternative media that have covered these topics. And I want to underline something that, you know, this debate is about here in the United States, but I'm trying to ring the alarm bell that the globalization of this approach is headed. I was in Turkey this spring and saw the process of the globalization of this approach with a forced electroshock without anesthesia going on as people try to westernize their mental health care approaches. So on the horizon are people in Africa and South America and Asia on all these drugs. And at the same time, the last few years, within the medical literature, there's now proof through brain scans, autopsies, animal studies, that the main drug that we've been talking about here today, the neuroleptics, that's what's used on us, diagnosed schizophrenic, typically, is linked to brain damage, actual frontal lobe brain damage. And again, we're pro-choice. Some people take anti-cancer drugs that are dangerous, but the public doesn't know. The medical literature, it's in there. They talk about it frequently, but the mainstream media doesn't. And the only time we're in the mainstream media is when one of us is involved with a violent act. Then it's all over the darn news. Up in Portland, we went to Jim Chassie's memorial. 90 of us marched from the Alternatives Conference, candlelit procession, to the memorial for Jim Chassie that was who was killed by three police officers. He had a psychiatric label, and it was a wonderful memorial, but I just really felt what a lack of information there is about our movement, about who we are, even about what we want to be called. Throughout the evening, I counted 24 times that we were called the mentally ill. And it's like, stop it. You know, learn from us, hear from us.
And Daniel Fisher.
I want to see a change in how we're portrayed, not only in terms of, there's a more subtle problem, and that is that our media holds up examples of the way everyone is supposed to be, that people are supposed to fit specifications, have to, you know, be very thin if you're a woman, and, you know, have to be very athletic if you're a man, and these images, these portrayals by the media, I think are as much a source of distress and ultimately mental illness as the negative portrayals of people labeled mental illness. And I think it's the flip side of it, that the media says, look like this, be like this, don't look like that. Don't look like those people on the street, and don't act that way. And we need to have a range of tolerance of appearances of people and of behaviors of people. We're getting very, very narrow in our specifications of how people are supposed to look and act.
This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
It's 6 p.m. right now at KBOO. We just heard from Marlise Franklin there, doing a special on the global movement of mental health treatment survivors. Her guests were David Oakes of Mind Freedom and Dr. Dan Fisher of the National Empowerment Center. As I said, it's 6 o'clock, and coming up right now, we've got more specials. The KBOO Report, produced by Cherie Blackfeather. It's coming up right now on your listener-supported nonprofit community radio.
This is KBOO Reports for November 2006.
The public education system in America is one of the most important foundations of our democracy. After all, it is where children from all over America learn to be responsible citizens and learn to have the skills necessary to take advantage of our fantastic opportunistic society.
Listen, my children, and you shall hear the sound of your own steps, the sound of your hereafter. Memory awaits and turns to greet you, draping its banner across your wrists. Wake up, arms, delicate feet, for as one to march the streets, each alone, each part of another. Your steps shall ring, shall raise the cloud, and they that will hear, will hear, will hear. Voice of the one and the one and the one, as it has never been uttered before. For something greater yet to come than the hour of the prophets in their great cities. For the people of Nineveh fell to their knees, heeding the cry of Jonah, united, covering themselves in sackcloth and ashes, and called to their God. And all their hearts were as one heart, and all their voices were as one voice. God heard them, and his mind was moved. Yet something greater will come to pass. And who will call, and what will they call? Will they call to God, the air, the fowl? It will not matter if the call is true. They shall call, and this is known. One voice, and each another, shall enter the dead, the living flower, enter forms that we know not, to be felt by sea, by air, by earth, and shall be an elemental pledge. This is our birthright. This is our charge. And we have given over to others, and they have not done well. And the forests mourn, the leaves fall. Swaddling babes watch and wonder as the fathers of our spirit nations dance in the street in celebration, as the mountains turn pale from their nuclear hand, and they have not done well. Now, my children, you must overturn the tables, deliver the future from material rule, for only one rule should be considered, the 11th commandment, to love one another. And this is our covenant across your wrist. This offering is yours to adorn, adore, to bury, to burn, upon a mound, to hail, to set away. It is merely a cloth, merely our colors, invested with the blood of a people, all their hopes and dreams. Our flag, it has its excellence, yet it is nothing. It shall not be a tyranny above us, nor should God, nor love, nor nature. Yet we hold as our pleasure this tender honor that we acknowledge the individual and the common ground formed. And if our cloth be raised and lowered half-mast, what does it tell us? That an individual has passed, is saluted and mourned by his countrymen. This ritual extends to us all, for we are all the individual, no unknown, no insignificant one, nor insignificant labor, nor insignificant act of charity. Each has a story to be told and retold, which shall be a glowing thread in the fabric of man, and the children shall march and bring the colors forward, investing within them the redeeming blood of their revolutionary hearts.
Happy New Year, everybody. Tamara Wallace, you've been involved with Theater of the Oppressed for 7 years. You want to talk a bit about how you got started and interested in that?
Sure. Theater of the Oppressed was developed in Brazil, and Augusto Boal is the person who wrote the book Theater of the Oppressed. He basically described this whole body of theater techniques, which he developed and also borrowed from lots of other communities who've been using theater for a while. It was shortly after the WTO protests in Seattle in 99 that I was really inspired by the theater and the art that I saw there in the streets. Mm-hmm. And I connected with a group called Art and Revolution and met some really great artists and theater folks here who introduced me to the idea of Theater of the Oppressed. So it's been since 1999 that I've been reading as much as I can about it, teaching workshops when I can, and going to whatever trainings that I can.
And you've actually been to Brazil and done some of that work there with people there?
I went to the Rio Center for Theater of the Oppressed for a visit, and I'm hoping to go back. And I spent some time traveling and working with activists in the landless movement, Brazil's Movimento Sem Terra, the MST, and they use Theater of the Oppressed and popular theater in their organizing. So I had this really amazing experience of getting to see how theater was used in a big social movement, which was very exciting.
What Augusto Boal says about Theater of the Oppressed is that it's rehearsal for life.
Let me read a little portion that Boal wrote, because I think he says it very clearly. This is from his book, Rainbow of Desire. He says, "The Theater of the Oppressed has two fundamental linked principles. It aims, A, to help the spectator transform himself into a protagonist of the dramatic action and rehearse alternatives for a situation so that he may then be able to, B, extrapolate into his real life the actions he's rehearsed in the practice of theater." So it's to turn the participants who experience a form of oppression into protagonists in their own life, people who are able to make a change, and then to better prepare them to take action in real life.
How do you go from that place of identifying an oppression that someone is experiencing to a transformative experience where they could feel empowered to change that?
There are a lot of specific ways to do that, but in a really general sense, you may ask a person or a community to sculpt what their situation looks like, what the actual concrete oppression looks like.
And so when you say sculpt, what are you talking about?
Basically, people offer themselves as participants, and they allow themselves to be sculpted into different positions. So maybe you'll have a group of five people and someone has a particular story about an oppression where there was themselves as the person who was oppressed, then there were maybe two people who were acting as oppressors. There was maybe a potential ally, somebody that had the capacity to take action but didn't do it. Somebody would actually take five actors and move them either. It could either be realistic or it could be symbolic or metaphorical, but in some way move them into positions that represent what that actual scene was like.
And then that creates the image.
That's how the image is created.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the things that's interesting to me about where Boal started was in Brazil, an environment where the oppressor was more easily identified by a large group of people, like many people shared the same oppression, like experienced the same oppression, and it was easier to identify, not necessarily easier to endure,
mm-hmm.
but easier to identify who is the oppressor and who is the oppressed. And you were saying that in the workshop that he developed these techniques, like image theater, for working in Europe, where the oppression is more subtle. And what struck me from going through this workshop, when we did the image theater, sculpting people into images of oppression, each one of us had an opportunity to use all the actors and sculpt an image.
Mm-hmm.
And the images were so different.
Uh-huh.
And what was interesting about it is that they were also extremely personal. And so that I actually didn't know what most of those images, like they didn't resonate with me. And I thought, oh, that's really interesting. No wonder we don't understand each other's oppressions.
Mm-hmm.
So we could talk about that. That was really fascinating to me.
Sure. I think, you know, I'm not actually sure. I believe image theater was created in Brazil with the original, with the groups he was working with. And he originally started work with, he says peasants, but it, basically the landless people in Brazil, people who are really oppressed, who work on the land but work in conditions that are like slavery, basically. They don't have political rights. They may not have rights to water. And so those were some of the people that he was originally working with. And the problem in those cases was often pretty clear. But it's important to also realize that within, you know, he says this later on, that even though the initial problem seems very clear, the community experiences all sorts of other problems too, right?
Of course.
So,
well, so I think, you know, an example of that is when they said, oh, this group of people are oppressed by the government. That's the oppressor. We are the oppressed. But once they started doing theater with the folks that were oppressed, all these other oppressions within the community started to surface, like sexism and things like that.
Right. But you're right that the communities that he was originally working with were more homogenous. They had, my understanding anyway, is that they had more of a shared culture, more of a shared problem, and more of a sense of clarity about who their oppressor was,
mm-hmm.
And who they were, and what the problem looked like. Working here is very different, especially in a workshop like you participated in, where we have people who've never met each other before. Most of the people in that group never had, who experience, who are probably members of different communities even within this city,
right.
And who are experiencing different kinds of problems. So in cases like that, when we do image theater, the images of oppression look very different. And he writes about this in his book. He said sometimes you are able to create one image that is reflective of all of the group's oppression, and then you have a group that shares a problem, and you can work towards a collective change using the theater. Sometimes you have a group where there are many different forms of oppression, and you can create a number of images, but you will have to choose to work on one of them at a time, because the way that you address one type of oppression isn't the same as the way that you address another.
Right, and that's interesting. I realize we just had one day to do that, but that was one of the questions that I had for you in the workshop toward the end, was how do you work on all those different parts? And you said over a long period of time, you know, like you get to, especially if you could work with a group of people that you get to develop trust with. That made a lot of sense to me. And that's of special interest to me because I've worked in activist groups and nonprofit organizations with these wonderful missions, you know, ideals, that we always fall short of.
Uh-huh.
And people seriously mean well. I think it is those very individual, kind of very personal, and even isolated. We feel very isolated in our oppressions in this culture, that it makes it hard to go, where do we start? Well, whose oppression are we going to work on first? And like you said, it's not the same. The solution or answer isn't the same to every kind of oppression.
Mm-hmm. And I think it is particularly true in groups where there's people from lots of different perspectives working on different issues. Cup in the head is a technique that Boal developed after he was exiled from Brazil, went to Argentina, which was also under the military dictatorship, and then self-exiled to Europe, where he tried to continue to do theater work. And his first response when he went to Europe was, oh, there's no oppression here. I don't see the people with guns, which is what he was facing when he was in Latin America. And then after a while of doing work, he realized people were expressing the same problems over and over. They were saying, I have this feeling of isolation. I have this feeling that I can't do anything, that the situation's hopeless. He also said that after studying a little, he learned that it had a very high suicide rate, really high drug use. And so he said, well, there must be some reason for this. These people are expressing the same problems. There must be some sort of oppression, but we can't necessarily see it. So this is where the idea of cop in the head came from, that there are forces that are oppressive, but they're not visible. You can't necessarily see them in the outside world, but that they do have some sort of origin in the outside world. So the idea of cop in the head is that you take a situation where a particular person is unable to act, feels like they're not able to take action, and you look at what are the characters in their head, what is it in their head that is making them think that they can't take action. And with the cop in the head, he says you need to choose particular real characters. They couldn't be something really general like the government or the television, but they actually had to be components of the person's real life, real, maybe a parent, maybe a teacher, but people who have had some sort of influence and impact over the person who's doing it.
I think that's really key. And the reason this work is interesting to me, Tamara, is that reason right there, because what I encounter a lot with activists, it's real easy to go, the government, you know, and look for this really big oppressor to sort of focus all their frustration or whatever, you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And what I don't see that empowering anybody is the thing. I think it's sort of, it's an illusion almost.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And one of the ideas that Boal writes about in his book Rainbow of Desire is that every incident in real life, something that happens on the street corner, something that happens at the doctor's office, in some way reflects the larger political situation. He says it's a microcosm of the larger problems in society. And so therefore, instead of necessarily starting with the really big problems, in Theater of the Oppressed, we look at where do those actually impact people on a daily basis.
Right.
What incidents that happen every day at your work or in the street corner or in your home are oppressive? And then how do you begin to start thinking about taking action against those? It is possible also in the work to look at what he calls the macrocosm, the larger political situation, which is also really useful to see, well, if this is your situation in the home, what is the situation outside in the larger context? But that is a key idea of Boal's, that all of these incidents in our lives are relevant and they do impact us and keep people in an oppressed situation unless people find the capacity to make those changes in small ways in their life.
And there's nothing more disturbing than trying to take something, to take experiential learning and then, like, ruin it with a bunch of intellectual garbage. So,
right. And one of the things that I love and find really inspiring about this work is that it's not a recipe, even though people may want to use it as a recipe, and that to do it well, you really need to have intuition and you need to trust your intuition, which I think is something that is not really valued in our culture and even in activist culture, to say, well, in this space, we don't really know what's going to happen and we're going to be taking risks, and some of them are logical risks and some of them we're going to take based on what we intuit about the situation.
See, I guess Seattle was a great experience for me in that way, the WTO protests. There was a lot of, I don't know what's going to happen. That's the same thing, I guess. It's like people felt very present to me in Seattle, whereas every other protest I've been to since then did not have that quality.
Mm-hmm.
It's felt formulaic. I mean, I understand people's intention or desire to address some wrong, but I feel like it's really lacking something.
Well, people are inspired by possibility and by trying for something that you don't know. You don't know what's going to happen. And I think when people take risk together collectively, it creates that sort of presence that you're talking about. And I think on a big scale, that happened in Seattle. And on a much, much more, you know, tinier scale, it can happen using this theater. Mm-hmm. So to me, that's the connection. It brings people present. They're taking a risk. You don't know what's going to happen. And you're trying to make change, and you're trying to imagine possibilities.
In Seattle, I could feel that we collectively owned the space that we were in. We collectively took the risks we were taking. There was a real sense of collective responsibility. Eventually, we weren't this group and that group and this group anymore. We were the people that live here. You know, we are citizens together. We are, and all those group things just dissolved.
Uh-huh.
We are the people who are oppressed by this situation that's going on in this building over there.
Mm-hmm. And I think that is what happens through action,
mm-hmm.
not through sitting around and talking.
Right. Right after the WTO, I mean, for months right afterwards, people were like, I didn't come here for a meeting. I did not come here to sit around in a meeting anymore. I want to take action. But what people were trying to figure out is what action.
Right. Right. It is too simple to say that you can't have meetings, right?
Right.
But maybe what it is that we need new ways of talking to each other and new ways to have those meetings and to develop ideas for action. And that's where I think the theater can be really useful, in that, you know, if the language of a meeting itself is an obstacle to coming to any sort of understanding or any sort of action, that there must be a better way to do it. You know?
Yeah, we could open ourselves up to other ways to work together to arrive at how to take action.
Right.
As I feel that a lot in a meeting. I mean, of course, why the heck would you really be there? It's like, we want to do something.
Right.
Here. Yeah.
Well, that reminds me, really quickly, I was rereading a book that I loved back when I was just leaving high school, called Impro by Keith Johnstone. And one of the things that, in rereading it, I'd forgotten about was that this former teacher ended up starting sort of a theater group, and that he hated the board meetings. So what he determined, he and I guess whoever he was working with, is that you could only put proposals through if you enact them using theater. So they actually started scheduling their board meetings in a theatrical way. And he said it saved so much time. He said so much time was spent with what he calls status transactions, people saying, oh, I know this, and, oh, well, I know this. It's sort of this pecking order thing that happens.
Yes.
That he said, you know, the theater pretty much bypasses that. Or if it happens, you see it right away.
Right, it's because it's dramatized.
It's there, and you are dealing with it.
Mm-hmm.
So there's an idea.
I like it. Thank you so much.
You're so welcome. Thanks for talking to me.
Okay, we'll do it again.
Okay, great. Okay.
Chaos Network is a diverse and cutting-edge community arts center located in the historic Leimert Park Village in Los Angeles, California. This unique center devotes itself to training others in digital arts, media arts, and multimedia. providing classes and workshops in video production, animation, digital arts, video teleconferencing, artist development, and drop-in performances, open mic programs. Each week, over 150 youths participate in workshops and programs there. In addition to these workshops, Chaos Network has videotaped community events and produced documentaries for the state of California. Another and more broadly known program which has bloomed from the center is Project Load. A workshop designed to challenge and sharpen the skills of all hip-hop heads, from MCs to dancers, graffiti artists, DJs, and of course, listeners. For over 11 years, Project Load has produced some of the most gifted and eclectic artists from not only the LA area, but all over the world. Together, these artists have sold over 1 million records to date and have created some of hip-hop's most duplicated sounds. I met up with director Ben Caldwell during a visit to the center this last summer.
I'm a filmmaker who graduated with a master's degree in film and television. And I came to Los Angeles. I'm from New Mexico. And all of my friends who graduated with degrees like in doctors and lawyering, they would go to a community and put up their slate and say they're operating. So I said, let me do the same. You know, so I focused on first working with all the community organizations in the neighborhood that didn't have any cameras, the film, couldn't tell their stories. So I started working with them, and I started initially at the Watts Towers, and then I worked with the Grape Street, and then we started then to, with all the schools in that area, and then just built up to where then I started this facility over here in the Leimert Park area, because people can come here real easy, and all the buses lead to Leimert in a lot of ways, so it would make it easy for the kids to come, and it was also a safe space. So I ended up making this the home for the work that I did in 84, where the kids could start coming here. And also in 84, I worked with the Olympics, where we connected communities through teleconferencing. And with the teleconferencing, it made it where I also got that underlay of doing networking communities. So that's where my process led me to then teaching at CalArts. And at CalArts, I was teaching there where we taught new technologies and also taught at a community partnership where we would started connecting with 22 sites around the city, and I would help train the students in the college on how to properly enter a community. And so we would do a semester of studying, like, what's a scripted community? You know, how is communities pre-scripted? How do you go to a community and first understand that scripting, and then how not to fall into it if you're from other cultures, you know? And then the histories of the communities and the areas. So all those are the kinds of things that we would blend in, and we would create work, and then they would see each other. So we would do these interconnections through, you know, through a large screen projection system, and then they would talk to each other through wireless mics and say, hey, how you doing in East LA? How you doing in West? How you doing in Valencia? What's up? You know, and just meet each other and cross these kind of cultural boundaries that LA have, and to do it as a test for what I'm wanting to do internationally, you know. So that was what the thought process was. And so now I'm on the process of wanting to do these kinds of facilities internationally and nationally, where we can drop down in a community that needs help, and we can have the kids and then work with them and have teachers from the communities, have ideas from the community, and make it help facilitate the ideas and how to interwork with the colleges and high schools. All the work that we've done in the sense of groundworking is to help drop that there as a kind of a map. So that's what I'm doing now with the community stuff.
Who are some of the artists that have come through here?
Artists. I mean, the person that's the most well-known of all of them was Label Makara, and he's the guy who did that opening song to Lion King. And he was one of our first hip-hoppers, if you could believe that, in the 80s when I worked with him. And then we have Yo-Yo, and we have Candyman, we have AC, have Ganja K, Medusa, AC Alone, of course, and Abstract Rude, Tumex, Among Your Consejo. It's just on and on. We have about 150 groups, you know. So it's a pretty strong group. And when we get together anniversary-wise, this is our 12th year of being together as Project Bload, easy 3,000, 4,000 youth gather.
Before I was recording, you were talking a little bit about the community and some of the musicians that were here before this project ever happened, or even thought of.
Well, yeah, well, the community musicians here are like Horace Tapscott and Billy Higgins. And I mean, this place is like, you know, Carl Burnett, Horace Silver, all those guys used to do music here around the corner. I mean, you know, and then when I first came here, we had Hiroshima, we had Bobby Matos, all those guys we worked with in this community, you know.
Here, Ben Caldwell speaks on one of his current projects due to release in 07.
My current project is called La Buena Vida, The Good Life. And there was a organization that had health food here that was called The Good Life that was started by a family, Janie Goodkin. And what they did was they were able to also create a hip-hop venue. So I want to give homage to them because she had died too, and also wanted to talk about the good life that Los Angeles kids have that's a little bit different than what people normally see, because they were able to hone out an atmosphere of culture within this underground that was under the commercial hip-hop that was taking place in this city. Even the guys like NWA and all those guys were initially a part of the community programming, because I worked with them, at least especially Easy, in his younger ages. And a lot of those guys were just 100% hip-hop. They were, you know, hip-hop got them, and they wanted to profess their ideas within what was there, you know. And to me, I don't have any divisions between any of the kinds of ways that our people have chosen to speak about their life. And, you know, like Easy and the NWA, them, that's cool. The only process that happens that's bad in it is how the multinationals grab it and then push that as the only thing, because they bank it and they make it seem like that's the only thing that takes place in this community. So what I chose to do as a person who has studied culture, because my part of my degrees at school is in filmmaking and then also in ethnocommunication, so I came to this area as a kind of ethnocommunications person to look at the culture of African American kids here. But then not only that, but to then see their interaction with all the other cultures and to see how we could make it work. So the template that I ended up using was the Four Directions, because I really liked the way the Sioux Indian had thought about
it. Explain that briefly, like a summary of that.
The Four Directions just deals with that there are four families in the world, and one being our white brother, who's the youngest. Our Asian brother, who's more of, and what our white brother has to offer is technology, and his gift here is supposed to be giving it to the world, not necessarily using it to bomb and deplete the world. He's supposed to be using it to share and take us to the next level, like we're going anyway. But as a youth, they are doing it like young people, you know. Whereas the older groups are the yellow people, which they consider, you know, more of the Asian persuasion, and they have more of a culture that deals with, I guess you call it spirituality and handling. And then the African people from the black world, and they more have the sense of what would you call it, of the rhythm, the beat, the system, the communications. That is one of their hallmarks. And then within the native world, their hallmark is the land and understanding Mother Earth. And that's what they're supposed to do in the picture. So until we get all of our families on the round table and discuss things, we won't get an answer to the whole way of handling the earth. So that's basically it in a nutshell. And that's the one thing I've learned with the native culture, is that they have a real sense of a semblance with African thought processes, and I think that they traded and did things with each other way before the Anglo got into the picture, because the depth shows once they meet each other. And so part of the reason that I deal with this black and brown thing is because I think it's a division between two obviously people who have been colonized. It's the native people, who indigenous people who own the land. And to me, the word Latino is also a colonized tongue. And so that colonized tongue is another colonized tongue, English, which we have both black in English. We have both black in Latin, but they all predominate with the group that was both one grabbed from another country and used, but then we found as a friend the people who were the indigenous here, because they were also had their land grabbed and they were used the same way, except it was in opposite ways. And then they grew friendships, even though there were places where fires took place because of the divide and conquer modalities, like the Buffalo Soldiers and things like that. They were powerful in some positions, but in other ways they were used, you know. And so that kind of a balance between the two cultures of black and red, which is now brown, because even if you look at brown history, from 1945 and up, it's really indigenous culture. And then from 1945 down, it's the urban cultures that, of how it's amalgamated into becoming mostly like mestizo, you know. And so to me, what is really happening here, and I saw it clearly in South Africa, because I was raised in New Mexico, so I was raised mostly around what is native people, but the native people there call themselves Latino. But the native people in Swaziland call themselves African. You know, that's something they don't want the Latinos, the natives, to say here, is that they're, that this is their land. And that's where the real problem is. So that's why they're dividing and conquering each of them, because they're making the blacks seem like they're a problem, and then the Latinos make it seem like they're a problem, but it generates from the jail. And so...
What do you think are some of the most obvious examples of that, or some of the examples that may not be so obvious but have more impact on the division of the two people?
Well, in just telling the history, you know, because they make it seem like it's black and brown, you know, when it's really, I mean, it's not, you know, it's indigenous and African, you know. And we don't want to deal with it on that. And so then, because why? Because look at the Californians. You know, if you look at that history, even when you read it, it amazed me then, saying just straight out they didn't want it to be like Brazil, you know, because it was like Brazil until then. So basically here in California, it was like Afrocentric Brazil. And the whole area from 1900 on has been changed. So that's what I'm now doing, is I'm working on a project that's kind of re-looking at that time period, especially the last century, that last 20th century. And I wanted to also see where the Latinos in Cuba, the Afro-Latinos, where they were taking their music that's really phenomenal, because it was now being again influenced by American music, because there's this kind of this flow between the two countries that happens in a lot of different ways, I'm finding as I'm doing this project, because there are a lot of African Americans in Cuba and vice versa, even through, like, after the Civil War, before the Civil War, during Civil War, there were a lot of escaped Africans would go, just like the boat that they're leaving from Cuba to here, they were doing the same thing to get out of the United States, because yeah, there was a lot of things going on. So I got to meet some of those people, you know, Los Moñoquitos, the Matanzas, that's a group that left Florida, and they started that there, and they have a real authentic kind of Yoruba culture there. So anyway, the project that I'm working on is the first leg of just looking at the international aspects of what we have brought forth here, as this generation has brought forth this kind of fusion music that is being labeled hip hop, and whatever that label for this commercialized time period is, then that's it. But I don't see it any different than the whole flow of our music in the struggle of, it's just the story of how we're telling It's our story here in America, and it's all of those songs. You know, it isn't just that you want to call it the blues, but then we call it the reals. We call it singing reality. So that's what I think. All that whole time, everything, each generation that we call bebop, hip hop, rhythm and blues, jitterbug, all that's was the real stories of the time of those people, you know, and it got labeled for commercial reasons, you know, and got snagged while they were babies, you know. So anyway, the project I'm working on, La Buena Vida, is looking at all that. And then we took a group of Project Bloodians there, Medusa, AC Alone, Tumex, Fader, Riddler, and sisters like Moni, who were all rappers, and dealt with fusing them first as the performers there, and then later we documented the process of them creating an album there. And the thing that I was interested in was to have the black and brown youth look at each other in another world that spoke Spanish that was predominantly black. So then the whole questions of it being a colonized language will come up stronger. And then I think it'll hopefully do the same thing for our audience when we show the film. You know, so that's basically it. It's going to be a documentary straight ahead, but it's also going to be a film. I mean, it's also going to be a album, you know. And it has about 16 songs in it that we created in Cuba, and then also some of the original songs that they created here in Los Angeles. And what I'm going to do quickly is to tell a story of that struggle and the commonality of the struggle between the blacks and browns from the 1900s to now, and then start with Jose Martin in Cuba, and then talk about his trip here in the Americas, and then looking at El Norte through the eyes of its fresh kind of imperial muscles with the young Roosevelt, right, Teddy Roosevelt, and then on the opposite end of Pio Pico, who was the last kind of Latino of even African descent that was the original starters of that 22 families that came here of African descent. So I want to show that, and I also want to deal with the word Khalifa, you know, because Khalifa was this Amazon a mestiza that people wanted to see too. So I think that the name of California even has a mestizo a blend root. So to bring that kind of stuff out, because a lot of people don't know that, you know, and that our constitution in California is written in Spanish and English, you know, things like that I think needs to be brought out and how that happened. And so that's what the project's about in that sense, you know. We're close to, making the film bilingual. I've been showing 12-minute pieces of it so I can just pump up the conversation. I'm trying to release it in Europe first, because America is a strange place to be, you know, so I'm going to try to go to Paris first. And then that way we'll be able to deal with the diasporan countries that they've colonized in a good way, because we can hook it up there. And then I want to go to England and do the same thing. And then that way we can internationalize it a lot more. And then I want to spread out and then do a little more of those same kind of things, is to show that and even go to Outer Mongolia, you know what I mean? So we can go where this music has seeped in and it gives a vision of who we are. And if it does that, we should be in there controlling that image, not the person who colonized us. And that's our problem right now.
That was Ben Caldwell, director of LA's Chaos Network and Project Blow, a cutting-edge cultural and artistic community center. He spoke on the facility and on his current documentary, La Buena Vida. For more information, log on to www.projectblow.com. I'm Carlos Chavez.
As I've told a lot of folks in Texas over the years, I wish I knew the law. If I'm the president, we're going to have emergency room care. We're going to have gag orders.
Ah!
Chris Merrick, Program Director of KBOO. What is going on with the FCC?
Over the last year or so, the FCC has been making some rulings regarding indecent language. The rulings are inconsistent. So for all radio and television, public or non-commercial, it's difficult to figure out what is or is not acceptable. And the FCC is basically saying, if someone files a complaint against you, we'll decide if you're guilty or not. And if you're guilty, you're guilty. Then go to court, spend $40,000 to defend yourself legally, and then you'll find out if it's okay or not. 2 years ago, the fine was $7,000. In last year, it was $35,000, and now it's $350,000. And what the FCC is now doing is what we would call the erosion of freedom of speech, which is maybe it's indecent and we're going to punish you severely. And I think this is where the fight is now beginning. The FCC, if they rule that an entire song's indecent, regardless of context, we're starting to lose our First Amendment rights. Howard Lyman, who he's the author of the book about mad cow disease, and he's been in Washington lobbying. He and Oprah Winfrey were sued by the American Beef Council about contaminated beef. He was on KBOO in November, and he said, "You have no idea how much the right hates public radio. They want to kill it." That's NPR, CPB, mm-hmm. public television, public radio. They don't care about KBOO. They want to kill 500 public radio and television stations. They hate us. Anything they can do. What KBOO and other stations want to do is say, wherever you live, to contact your House of Representatives, officials, reps, and senators. At some point, the FCC has to be held accountable. They're a regulatory agency, which means they just create rules about broadcasting. And the rules are arbitrary, and they're capricious, and sometimes they are prejudiced. And until you go to a court, a district court or the Supreme Court, to deal with First Amendment and constitutional issues, the FCC wins. So you got to go to the FCC and say, what are the rules? And if they are acceptable, yes. If they're not, you're going to challenge them.
Richard Francis.
Yes. Host of A Different Nature on Thursday nights from 9 to 11. And I've been a programmer here at KBOO now for coming up on 27 years.
Wow. And what is the show? Talk about it.
Well, it's a show of new music and sonic art, which is really broad sort of definition. And the broadness of the show was intentional at the very beginning, because when I first came to KBOO, this will give you an idea of my inclinations. When I first came to KBOO, the station was composed of peer groups of classical programmers, jazz programmers, folk programmers, and I didn't want to have anything to do with that. I really wanted the show to be open and free.
Mm-hmm.
That's always been the intention. So I came in with a description when we put the proposal forward to the programming committee with something that knocked it completely out of any of those peer groups, so that it could just be an open communication between me and my audience and an open exploration of where sonic art was going.
It's a great show.
Thank you.
I've enjoyed it for years and years.
Mm-hmm.
So I hear you've been complaining lately.
Yeah, well, the new FCC restrictions, I was aware of them coming up. I just didn't realize how extensive they were. And we've had to deal with them before. And when I first came on, my show was on from 2 to 5 in the afternoon. And I was very much aware of the fact that there were children who were coming home with no parental supervision who could turn on the radio. And so I was very careful about what I played. So that is part of my consciousness. I'm aware of that. But at the same time, the way the restrictions are written now, I'm wondering if you might not get in trouble for reading parts of the Bible on the air. There's something about it. On my way here to do this interview, I was on a very crowded bus, and somebody passed gas.
Okay, and everybody reacted because it was offensive.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Well, that to me is sort of what we're talking about, is occasionally in the language somebody passes gas on the air. But it has been raised to the level of a high crime, $350,000 per incident. A show that I'm planning coming up here December 21st has got four offensive words in it. And so my show for the 21st is going to be moved back an hour because I refuse to mutilate somebody else's work for something so ridiculous. I'm sure that you could get in trouble if somebody was actually listening and understood Shakespeare. If you did some of the Shakespeare plays right now, you'd be in a lot of trouble with a lot of the Renaissance plays if you tried to put them on the air in the afternoon. And I remember when I first came to KABU, we would set aside once a year a day for the reading of Ulysses on the air, which we wouldn't be able to do now. And so what we're ending up doing is taking a radio station which really is dedicated to a multicultural understanding and really opening up free speech as much as possible. And we're turning it into broadcast aimed at first graders. And it ends up raising so many barriers at a place where we're trying to knock the barriers down. For instance, I enjoy every once in a while slipping off into another section of the library and pulling music from another country in another language, and I have no idea what is being said, but I enjoy the art of how it's put together or the music that's being created around it or something like that. Now, I would in the past have thrown it on. Now I can't do that unless I find somebody that can translate it and assure me that what I am playing is safe to play. So, and it really does strike me, you know, as I start examining what I can and can't approach now for my show, how much this has to do with attacking people in terms of class and race, and how much it limits what we can do here. Because before we were able to say, okay, there's a context. You know, we're not trying to be smutty. We're not trying to get away with something. This is something that is happening in the vernacular that you hear when you walk down the street. You know, this is something that you hear every day. Is now going to cost us $350,000? You know, we are really trying to bring perspectives on other cultures and other kinds of awareness. And it really has offended me to realize the extent to which I am forced to participate in the enforcement of a sense of reality and culture and humanity that I am diametrically opposed to. I'm forced to speak in a lesser language. This is all being done without anybody being able to point to any damage that happens with the use of these words. And it's this insane sort of thing that seems to be happening with the people who are in power right now, that it's part of that Orwellian newspeak. You know, that if people aren't exposed to the words, then they're not going to have the thoughts.
Right.
That what we are dealing with is some sort of alien thing that comes into us from outside. The devil made me do it. That sort of thing.
Yeah.
And as long as we can purge the language and purify human communication, then we won't have those awful things. But this is talking about a sense of humanity where there's nothing between the belly button and mid thigh.
Right.
You know, and all of that is forbidden. That doesn't happen. One of the primary drives that makes us human beings is not to be discussed, is not to even be broached, except in the most scientific terms. So it's lessening communication.
That's what bothers me.
Yes. Well, that's what it comes down to. That's the crux of it. It's limiting communication in an organization where that's the primary thing. And I really do think that is one of the reasons for the height of the fine. I think it really is aimed at organizations like ours, at stations like ours, community stations, which present an alternative point of view. Mm-hmm. And it's a really way to make us very vulnerable. This was done during the Reagan years when any of the stations that were connected with Pacifica were broadcasting the Iran-Contra cocaine stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And the Reagan administration was completely losing its mind on this information that was getting out. And they decided that the one thing that made all of us vulnerable was our gay programming. And so they went after KPFA for a reading of Jerker that came on after 11 o'clock at night. And, you know, I got a phone call then from the program director. He says, well, you know,
I talked to Walt, and I talked to Howie, and I talked to Charlie, and now I'm talking to you, and I'm thinking, okay, what do all these names have in common? Okay, we're all faggots. And we were all told to cool it. Pretty offensive, because it was kind of couched in the terms of you guys have to behave yourselves because we have more important things to talk about that we don't want to lose.
Mm-hmm.
And that I found offensive. But eventually, everybody got their stuff together, and we ended up simultaneously broadcasting Allen Ginsberg reading Howl.
And live?
And that ended that.
Wow, that's fantastic.
Yes.
But I don't think
we can do that now, because I think they would go after every single station. I think they would. And I think that they would go after us at $350,000 a pop. But I really think that if there are people out there who really have an understanding of what KABU is about and who really enjoy the kind of variety that we've been able to bring and the range that we've been able to put into our broadcasting and the number of communities that we've been able to bring in, then you know how important it is to have freedom of speech happening here.
Mm-hmm.
And to limit it to the period from 10 o'clock at night till 6 o'clock in the morning really ghettoizes a great deal of programming that used to be available here.
It's not just those words or those songs, but it seems like free expression, period,
yes,
becomes something you do after 10 o'clock.
That's exactly it.
You know?
That's exactly it.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it's not just what's being limited, as I said, but it's also what we're being forced to do, because we are being forced to propagate a certain perspective about sexuality and human physicality that I don't agree with, and I don't think you do either.
Right.
I think, in fact, we're radically opposed to the contemporary understanding of, you know, sex. But you're suddenly left with the only times that we really sort of elevate any sort of human physicality is in conflict,
right,
in sports or in advertising, where our bodies are turned into commodities. Mm-hmm. But in, you know,
or war.
Yeah, or war. Yes. There's that too. So, which is conflict again? That's pretty limiting, and that's a really sad perspective and understanding of the human body and of the human experience, I think. And that's what I find ultimately frustrating about all of this, is the extent to which I'm co-opted to become, because I am a communicator on the air, my message is going to be necessarily distorted into something that I don't intend it to be.
Right. Thank you to Carlos Chavez, producer of Chicanismo, a great public affairs show that examines the cultural evolution of Chicanos in America through art, history, and politics, and dialogue. You can listen to Chicanismo on KABU, December 14th at 10 a.m. Richard Francis hosts a no-censorship solstice when a different nature starts an hour later than usual, tune in on December 21st at 10 p.m. till midnight. For updates on the FCC issues and your First Amendment rights, go to the KBOO website at www.kboo.fm. This has been KBOO Reports for November 2006, produced by Cherie Blackfeather.
Calendar for Wednesday, November 29th. The Clinton Street Theater presents the film Stealing America, Vote by Vote by Emmy Award-winning director Dorothy Fadiman. The film shows tonight, a showing at 7 o'clock p.m. and 9 o'clock p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. Admission is a sliding scale donation of $5 to $15, which benefits the Portland Alliance newspaper. Stealing America, Vote by Vote documents significant irregularities in the 2004 presidential election while underscoring the fact that election fraud and reform are not partisan issues. The film weaves together dramatic behind-the-scenes experience of poll workers, computer security experts, journalists, politicians, activists, and voters of all ages. We hear from those who feel their communities were targeted for intimidation during the election, side by side with descriptions of irregular machine tallies in which the number of votes tallied didn't equal the number of votes cast. For more information on tonight's film, visit the web at theportlandalliance.org. L'Arche Nehalem, an East Portland nonprofit community for persons with developmental disability, is holding its annual benefit Christmas tree sale at two locations from December 1st through 18th. The tree lots at Southeast 82nd and Burnside and Northeast 44th and Hancock near Sandy Boulevard will be open from 2:30 p.m. to 8:30 p.m. Monday through Friday and 10 a.m. to 7 p.m. on weekends. A wide selection of Douglas and Noble firs, fresh cut from local farms and delivered frequently, are available at great prices. L'Arche Nehalem is one of a network of over 120 communities worldwide in which developmentally disabled people live as equal and valued members with assistance in a family environment. This is a major fundraiser for L'Arche Nehalem, and all the proceeds go directly to help the residents of its two homes. For more information or to volunteer for a three-hour shift, call the L'Arche office, 503-251-6901, 503-251-6901. All are invited to a season of peace sale of green, local, and recycled treasures. The sale benefits the education and community programs of the Quaker Meeting. They'll have the goods and services with artistic and international flair gathered from members of the community, including antiques, vintage clothing and jewelry, quilts, original art, sports equipment, and collectibles. Refreshments will be served. Join them this Sunday, December 3rd, from 2 to 5 p.m. at the Friends Meeting House. That address is 4312 Southeast Stark Street in Portland. For more information, visit the web at multnomahfriends.org or call 503-292-1817, 503-292-1817. And this has been the Community Calendar. I'm Alicia Olson for KBOO, listener-sponsored community radio in Portland, Hood River, and Corvallis.
This program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Cotton Cloud Futons, a locally owned business featuring futons and mattresses, frames, covers, furnishings, and accessories which can be made with organic and recycled materials. Cotton Cloud is located at 701 Northeast Broadway in Portland. Information at 503-335-0758 or cottoncloudfutons.com.